Why is escalating a trap and not a way out to have a military victory?
Because the trap is not just an escalation ladder. The trap is when you escalate to stage one, you're tactically successful. Bombs hit targets, kill leaders, but strategically failed. And even if you saw it, Pete Hegseth is still saying Iran could become a nuclear power. Think about that. He's admitting essentially strategic failure to this point. So he, even in his own victory narrative, is revealing the failure. And then it's gotten worse because Iran has lashed back since Feb 28, and now it controls 20% of the world's oil, Strait of Hormuz. This has leverage and power. So it's not just simply a weakened thing. They're not losing, they're gaining power, meaning we've lost another strategic objective, preventing the oil hegemon that we've wanted to prevent in the Middle East for 50 years, since the 73 OPEC crisis. Well, that's what's sucking us into the trap, because we're thinking, oh, maybe we could, if we just would double down this and try this, we will be able to somehow pull a rabbit out of the hat and extricate ourselves. That's the logic of Vietnam, the search for the breaking point in Vietnam, which went on month after month, year after year, until the whole balloon bursts. LBJ became the LBJ, complete lame duck, the most failed president we've really had. He is the epitome of the failed president here due to a foreign war. This is the trajectory that President Trump is heading toward. And so this is really the sucking in here. It's the fear of failure in history. That's what's sucking President Trump up. You can think of it into the trap, up the ladder, but it's beyond simply, this is the sucking sound. It's that fear of he's going to become LBJ in history forever.
That's a pretty dark path to go down, something President Trump wouldn't exactly like to be compared to. Interesting, though, that there's others who are coming to a similar conclusion. This recent statement by James Mattis, former four-star general, came to about the same conclusion you did on the difference between tactics and strategy.
Targetry never makes up for a lack of strategy. And by that I mean 15,000 targets have been hit. There have been significant military successes, but they are not matched by strategic outcomes. Now, some of the strategic outcomes early on, unconditional surrender, regime change, we're going to dictate who the next supreme leader is, those were clearly nonsense. Those were delusional.
Yeah, let's ask about that. That last part he was talking about.
So what you are seeing there, Danny, is I now have something like 35,000 followers, subscribers on the Substack, the Escalation Trap, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. Before the war, there was nothing. So this has gone from nothing to this. And a lot of them are very important people. They're journalists. They're very important people. And what you are seeing is the frameworks. The reason I started the Escalation Trap, this isn't just commentary. This is frameworks for understanding what's happening to us, how we got here, and where we're heading. And that framework, tactical success, strategic failure, I would venture to say that was nowhere on the airwaves until a month ago, and it's been growing. That's one of the very first frameworks I put on the Escalation Trap. That's one of the framework I used when I taught for the U.S. Air Force, because I started to understand. They're great at putting bombs on target. Yes, they want a political outcome that the president orders, but the problem here is that misunderstanding that tactical success doesn't equal strategic success. Bombing to win, whole chapter on this. I really, really focus on that set of concepts, because once you get it, now you know you can plug in so much of the world. And that's what you're seeing. You see this, I see this all the time now. New, and I'm glad this much of it, not everything for free on the Substack, but almost everything for free. And what you are seeing is the world is starting to take advantage of those frameworks.
And Gary, if you could put that screen back up there again with Dr. Pape's Substack on there, something that has my attention there, that one in the middle, the gambler's conceit in war. Now, before I ask you about that, I want to give you a very fresh potential example and tell me if you see it, because given what James Mattis just said, we showed there, and what you have said here, take a look at Hegseth yesterday bragging about how we have the most amazing success in all of history.
Never in history has a modern military, Iran had a modern military, a modern navy, a modern air force, modern air defenses, leadership, massive bunker. Never has a modern military been so rapidly and historically obliterated, defeated from day one with overwhelming firepower. The air campaign that we've conducted, that Israel's conducted alongside us, was one for the history books, truly. And it's because we have a president of the United States that when he sends his warfighters out to fight, he unties their hands to actually go out and close with and destroy the enemy as viciously as possible from moment one.
That almost sounds like a guy who's talking like at the victory parade after a war has been won, and look at this great thing we did, instead of at the very beginning where things are not exactly lining up.
And also,
that is the gambler's mentality.
It's the gambler's, but also notice how much he sounds like Robert McNamara. For those of you who were around, doesn't that bring back Robert McNamara language here?
Okay.
Now let me talk about the gambler's fallacy, that gambler's curse, because I had a book half done called The Smart Bomb Trap, and I was going to have a chapter in there on this. And now, why is it that these strong countries get themselves into these traps here? And people are asking this over and over and over again. Well, they keep going for data. They keep saying, well, if only I had the secret signal trap, I would have. No, that's not going to help them clarify this. What's going to clarify it is understanding that for big, strong powers in history, pre-World War I Germany here, in Vietnam here in 65 and 66, et cetera, these big, strong powers had successes, or at least perceived successes, much the way gamblers do sometimes when they go into the casino. Yes, the house is supposed to have the advantage, but what if you go into a casino on blackjack and you win 20 hands in a row? Now the casino's really gotcha. And why is that? It's because once you've won 20 in a row, you start to lose. Well, now you double down thinking, oh, I beat the system of the casino. And what you do is you not only run out of the money you made on the house, you bet your own house. And that is Richard Thaler, economist, Nobel Prize winner, University of Chicago. I want to be a big plug for the University of Chicago here. That idea I have taken from him, and I give him credit in there here in the Substack. It will be in there. But my point is, I am using that to explain the question everybody's asking: how could this possibly happen? This is the gambler's curse, and you don't just run the table out of house money. You bankrupt the house, and here we are the house. Trump's playing with other people's money, other people's lives. That's the real disaster in front of us.
And we just see it playing out. And you've said a couple of times, you talked about McNamara there. And I want to run back here to this ex post you had, because again, you've mentioned Vietnam. You talk about, and if I wonder if you could go a little bit detail here. You say this issue with Iran is not just negotiating with the U.S., it's choosing which American to negotiate with. And then you say this is not new. North Vietnam did the same thing. What if you could explain a little bit about what happened to Vietnam?
Absolutely.
And what's happening now?
That's right. And this was the Substack I put out this morning. So you can see I went to bed at midnight, got up at 4. So this is my life here. And what I'm trying to explain is, Iran is not conceding. What Iran is doing is, okay, President Trump, you're desperate for negotiation, pretty clear. So we're going to take advantage of that. And we're not going to work with your negotiators that are very pro-Israel. We're going to use the negotiations themselves to further crack your regime. And that's what's happening here. So they fully get, there's the Vance, Carlson wing, Joe Kent. This has fully been on display here. And it's no surprise that they're saying, you want to negotiate with us? Sure. Let's have J.D. Vance come on over. And why? Because that's going to deepen the crack in the Trump MAGA base. And you saw very similar things in Vietnam. For there were the Paris peace talks. Your listeners may not know, they start in 1968. They go on for 5 years. No, the North Vietnamese had no problem talking. Well, they were killing us for 5 years and lengthening the war. And what they were doing is doing very similar thing. They were trying to look reasonable, play on the divisions in America here, and so deepen the problem for America winning the long war. I think this is the same thing happening here. That's why I put it out so that we can understand. We think we're clever. I think we need to understand. We're up against somebody who's thought about this pretty hard, and they're coming up with some pretty clever ideas on their own. I'm not trying to say that they're 10 foot tall, but we got to stop treating them as if they're children and as if they're white belts. We're the ones who are not looking like black belts right now. And I don't mean the military. I'm talking about our senior decision making.
And is this an example of it right here? Speaking about X, this is the speaker of the Ukrainian, Iranian parliament. Said kind of like you, they're paying attention to what's happening, not just what's being told. We are closely monitoring all movements in the region, especially troop deployments. What the generals have broke, the soldiers can't fix. Instead, they will fall victim to Netanyahu's decisions. Do not test our resolve to defend this land. How do you?
And we need to understand, Danny, that they've got the help of Russian intelligence. They're probably getting the help of Chinese intelligence. They're probably getting the help of civilian satellite here. There is an enormous information that is out there, and there are 92 million people. One in eight people in Iran works for, is paid by the Iranian government. They've got a lot of people here to get on this, and this is what I'm trying to say. We're treating this like we're the NFL, and we're going up. We're Kansas City, and we're going up against a high school team. No, we need to understand. We may have been Kansas City a couple years ago, but there's some other teams that are getting stronger along the way. We need to understand. We're in the NFL now. This was the NFL, and we're up against an NFL team. We need to take this much, much more seriously.
And somebody who also takes it seriously is the Iranian side. You mentioned that for 5 years at the North Vietnamese side were negotiating with us, but while they were still fighting, but they were also receiving lots of attacks and destruction from the United States, just massive in the air, et cetera. And do you see any similarities between that and what this IRGC leader said here yesterday?
قدرت راهبردی که از آن دم می‌زدید تبدیل به شکست راهبردی شده. مدعی ابرقدرتی دنیا اگر می توانست از این مخمصه رها شود تا حالا شده بود. اسم شکستتان را توافق نگذارید. سطح خود درگیری هایتان به مرحله مذاکره خودتان با خودتان رسیده. نه خبری از سرمایه گذاری هایتان در منطقه خواهد بود و نه قیمت سابق انرژی و نفت را خواهید دید تا وقتی که بفهمید ثبات در منطقه توسط دست قدرتمند نیروهای مسلح ما تضمین می شود. کسی همچو ما با کسی مثل شما کنار نخواهد آمد. نه حالا و نه هیچ وقت دیگری.
So those are some pretty boisterous claims. The question is, can the Iranians, like the North Vietnamese, last 5 years if the war continues going on that long?
Well, they've got a lot of cards right now. They've got 20% of the world's oil. And as I was explaining on the live video briefing here on the Substack on Sunday, with those troops, those 5,000 Marines, the 82nd Airborne, they can start something. They can't finish something. So if they start, what's going to happen is they're likely going to pay a lot of costs here because the other side's likely going to fight. Unless the other side just gives up, we should expect something like 20% casualties. If we can keep it down to 10%, we're doing good. Right now, there are 13 dead military here. That's what we paid with the Afghanistan exit. This could go up by a factor of 10 over 24 hours. So this could be much, much different. And when that happens, politics is going to change, Danny. This is what I work on, how when you have military action, how it impacts politics. That's my specialty. That's the real paid specialty. And what is likely to happen here? the 40% of support for, or the 36% of support for this war, it will probably temporarily at least harden. Why? Because that 36% is going to see those 100 Marines died for me. I supported this. They died for me. And they're not going to want to just abandon their legacy of those 100 dead Marines. And that's how you keep doubling. That's how you keep the costs going up over time. So that's how this would go from a several day excursion, get ourselves a bloody nose. People would say, we get a bloody nose, we'll pull right out. You know, most likely, once you start, you're in for a dime, in for a dollar. This, I said on Sunday, you start this, you're probably in a 6-month war of attrition minimum.
And let's just take a look at those numbers here, because the issue of the amount of combat power that's being sent with the Ready Brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division, at least two Marine Expeditionary Units, the Tripoli will be there any day now. Apparently, the USS Boxer and its group, as you said a minute ago, about a week or 10 days after that. That's not enough to sustain something over 6 months. And if we go in there and let's say that it is Carg Island, it may not be, that could be a deception op. We don't know yet, but let's say that it is, or wherever it is, it doesn't matter. They go on there, they're able to get on board, but then, as you say, they're going to suffer lots of casualties because the reinforcements from the Iranian side, counterattacks, all that kind of stuff, air, you name it, they'll be going on for a long time.
This is going to be the beginning, Danny, of that escalation of the ground forces that we saw in Vietnam. It's almost going to be, and you're going to hear the analogy. I've been talking about that analogy. You will hear that analogy drung out even more. And people will say, why are we incrementally escalating again? And you'll hear it on both sides, by the way. But what you're really going to see is those troops, if they likely, and I'm sorry to say, because I have nothing but the greatest respect for them here, they will do everything possible, I'm sure. But they will, if ordered, they will go and do this, even if it means they die. And what that death will mean is politics is going to change yet again. And it's going to change on both sides. And it's not just going to mean that 36% is going to give up the ship, because suddenly now they have sent those people to their deaths. That's a heavy thing. And that's how that escalation happened in Vietnam. It's because people keep wondering, how could that possibly happen? Why incrementally all of that? We need to understand the way politics really works. And this is why I started to study this problem in the 1980s. So I've been studying Vietnam here and the escalation there. This isn't just the even the last few years. That was what my dissertation was focused on. That was one of my big cases in the 1980s. I wanted to know, how could this happen? This was the answer I found.